This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. If Iran continues to keep fuel hostage, if we here in Australia are heading for another fuel crisis, how much surge capacity is in our public transport system? If you had to depend on public transport right now, today, where you live, how would that play out? Are there plenty of seats on your peak time commute? Or are you cheek by jowl? I'd love to know. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour and we are talking about the fuel crisis, well, which we're already in. Maybe you've already turned to public transport. How has that turned out for you? Do we as a state in Victoria have the capacity to cope with a surge? Because the signs are there. This might just be the beginning now. Those seismic events over there in the Middle East are already affecting us and they're likely to have those ripple effects not just for weeks and months, potentially years to come. So this hour I'm going to be speaking to a couple of experts with differing levels of optimism, let's say, about the capacity for our public transport system to cope with a possible surge, if that's our way out of this. What do you think? 1300 222 774 is the number to call me. Does our public transport system have the capacity to handle the effects of a global fuel crisis? And what have you done already? We'll hear soon as well from someone who says buses might be the answer. What do you think? Are buses the answer? Do you agree? I'd love to know. Also, we've heard today, earlier this morning on Breakfast, how regional Victorian fuel station owners put a cap on customers over the past few days, limiting them to spending just $50 on whatever fuel they chose. Would you keep to a fuel cap? Should it be imposed? We heard a call from those regional Victorians for city folk to take one for the team. Maybe we should have a fuel cap put on us in particular. I'd love to hear how you think that would even work. We're going to explore how that might actually work. Also, we'll be keeping an eye on those Oscars. The red carpet's already been taken out for its annual spin this morning. It's probably being rolled up as I speak. We're going to get all the latest on that, the results as they come in, and what it's like to be there. We're going to be speaking to someone on the ground, on the side of that carpet, I think. We will be on that during this hour and also later. If you've given birth, what made the biggest difference to how safe and supported you felt? Looking back, what do you wish had been different? I'd love to hear from you. Keep this number in mind. We're going to come to this later. 1300 222 774. I'd love to hear your experiences, particularly when it comes to the importance of continuity of care. Did you get it? Did you not get it? I'd love to hear from you. We're going to be speaking about to a researcher who's talking about that and things that we can all learn for all of the loved ones in our lives who might be facing that experience, or to reflect on the lessons of our own experiences as well. 1300 222 774. We're talking about the birth experience a little later in the hour. But next, can our public transport system handle a surge in demand?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Dr. Jonathan Spear, who's CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. Hello, Jonathan.
Good morning, Mary. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. How well are we placed for a surge in demand when it comes to public transport?
Well, Mary, Victoria's public transport system does have capacity to deliver additional journeys at the moment, but it's going to have limits as well. And
what would they
be? Yeah, the limits are if we have strong demand for more people travelling in the peak times, or for people who are travelling in areas that are less well serviced by public transport already. But if we go back to, well, why is there some capacity in the system currently? We've had a reduction in the number of travellers on public transport after COVID, and it's had a patchy recovery of that demand. So if you look on the tram network or the bus network, there's a fair bit of demand still coming back. The trains, though, there's less people travelling on the trains, especially on Mondays or Fridays. So there's certainly some capacity there. And we've put much more capacity onto the network as well. Things like the Metro Tunnel opening up, it gives a lot more capacity to the system. But that will reach a limit at some point, particularly if everyone wants to travel in the peak of the morning or the evening at the same time.
So when the demand dropped then, Jonathan Spear, did the services drop as well? Or are you saying that they kept those services up to that pre-COVID standard and we still have that capacity left?
Well, there is capacity left. So what we see is that there is an ability to be running more train, tram and bus services, and that they're not fully utilised at the moment. The bus services are probably more utilised currently than, say, the trains. We know that they've been the slowest to recover. So we've got some of the capacity in the system there. But what we also know is that if we have more fast and frequently delivered bus system networks in our cities, then more people will use buses as well. So we've got that capacity there. But if everyone then wants to move to travel in the peak hour, we're going to reach some limits pretty quickly. The other challenge we've got is if you live in some of the regional Victorian cities or the outer areas of Melbourne, in the west, the north and the southeast, they don't have as good public transport networks. So even if someone wants to use it, the amount of services that are there are much lower.
Well, that's the nub of it, isn't it? We heard this morning about the situation for people in the regions, not just commuters and so forth, but obviously farmers. You know, you can't take public transport when you're doing harvesting. So how can public transport even be ramped up in those areas? Is that basically impossible?
It's not impossible. There's some short-term and then some longer-term things, Mary. So it may be possible to deliver more services in peak periods and deliver more services in regional cities with more buses in the short term. One of the ways that we can spread the load across the system is to have fares cheaper outside of those peak demand times in the morning and the evening. And if just a small number of people shift the time that they change, that makes it a lot easier for everyone else and for the whole system to run.
But that requires them being able to do that and their employers letting them do that.
Well, that's right. And some people have got greater flexibility than others. But for those who do have the ability to be flexible, if we have just a small number of people changing the times that they travel, that makes a big difference to how the whole network operates. But not everyone can do that, and not everyone can work from home either. So the longer run challenge we've got is that we've got some areas of regional cities and our other suburbs that just need more rail services to be delivered to them and more frequent, direct, reliable bus services that they know will get them to the jobs and education and services that they need. And so in Victoria's infrastructure strategy, which we tabled in Parliament late last year, we've got a whole lot of the solutions for government to be investing in fixing that longer run challenge of poor access to public transport in our outer suburbs and regional cities.
You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Spear, CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. It's coming up to 14 minutes past 11. You've mentioned buses there a couple of times. They're the answer as far as you're concerned. Is that right?
They're part of the answer because unlike heavy rail or trams, which take many, many years to deliver and extend, we can change and deliver our bus services quite quickly. And so that's a real advantage. And we can also change the routes that they drive so that they're more frequent and direct and give people a service that they actually find really valuable. So in the short run, that is a really big opportunity, as well as changing fares so that some people can change the times that they travel, or even things like the better information that we're starting to give passengers so they can make a choice about when and how they want to travel around.
Have you modelled the public transport system in Victoria in the sort of scenario of a crisis like we're facing?
No, we haven't, Mary. We do more medium to long-term modelling. One of the things we have modelled is what happens when more people choose to work from home, because around 30% of people can work from home. And that's certainly seen some changes in people's travel patterns. And much of that is actually what we've been living through in recent years, where we have this sort of patchy utilisation of public transport. But lots of people have started to use private vehicles, their cars, to get around much more than they were before COVID. Mm. And in some ways, this increase in petrol prices is a bit of a wake-up call to all of us about the need to continue to invest in more travel choices for how people want to get around.
And Jonathan Spear, I can tell you that the text line is running hot from people in regional Victoria who say, we don't have a choice. We don't have public transport either. So it sounds like that should be rocketing up to the top of the priority list for the government, would you say?
Yes. So in regional Victoria, we recommended improved coach services to run more frequently between our regional cities, and better bus services within cities and the areas around them. Because when we talk to regional Victorians, they tell us that's what they need and want. And while some people would like to have more rail services in regional areas between cities, that will take a long time to deliver. So delivering buses and coaches in the short run is a really effective way of meeting people's needs.
And it does sound like this crisis will have long-term effects, unfortunately. Dr. Jonathan Spear, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Mary.
Dr. Jonathan Spear is CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. We're going to continue this conversation, but you have been hopping onto the lines. Gary, you've called in from Langwarrin South, and you're a builder. How does that going to work for you, hopping on public transport?
Good morning, Mary. I'm a builder, and we can't work from home, and it's going to be real fun trying to get our tools and equipment, et cetera, and materials on the trains and buses. It just won't work.
So what are you thinking of doing? Carpooling with utes?
You can't do that.
Yeah.
It's a physical impossibility. So I don't know what we're going to do. If they shut the fuel down, we're just going to have to stay home and building will stop.
Yeah. Or the prices get put on to your customers. No doubt.
Well, we have to.
Yeah.
We can't absorb the government's inadequacies.
Gary, thank you so much for calling in. Briley, you've called in from Keilor. What have you got to say?
I was just, a bit worried about what I'm going to do as an apprentice. Like, I got a van full of tools. I've got to get to work somehow. And with the cost of the fuel going up, like, I've been to a couple of stations where all the fuel's gone, like already here in Melbourne City, So diesel especially, it's gone from a few, like, I've shut it off at a few gas stations.
Yeah, so we heard from Gary just before, and you're an apprentice there, Briley. How do you plan for a crisis and you don't know when it's going to end?
Well, yeah, especially, me being so young, like, I don't even understand half of this stuff, so it's, like, really stressful on my mind and what I'm going to do in these next few weeks,
Yeah, have you got your bosses, giving you some solutions?
Not really, to be honest. Not even he knows what to do, so it's kind of like everyone's in a bit of a kerfuffle,
Yeah. Briley, thank you. I think that's a really good perspective for people to hear that, there's just some confusion. People are just stuck. How can they get around these rising fuel prices? And there seems to be no end. And we'll just really quickly go to David from Northeast Victoria. What's been your experience, David, with these prices rising?
Yes, Mary. Thank you. I had a discussion with my fuel supplier this morning and they cannot supply fuel to my depot. I'm in a remote area of Northeast Victoria. And,
What's your business there, David, if you don't mind?
School buses.
Mm-hmm.
And, the flow-on effect, if kids can't get to school, parents have got to stay home to look after kids and it's just snowballs.
Yeah. David, I can see a lot of people on text echoing what you're saying. Thank you for calling in. We are going to continue this conversation. I'll get to more of your texts as well. People are talking about potentially catching the train every day because even with the price of fuel, it's more expensive than driving. I do it for environmental reasons, but consciously choosing to lose money by not driving, that's from Saskia, and also many more texts from people in the regions. Bree in Seymour says, I'm a nurse. I live 80 kilometres from my workplace due to several factors that I'm unable to change, and public transport isn't available at the time of day I need to start my shifts. It's just not an option for some of us. We'll continue the conversation next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Hussein Dia, who's a Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at the Swinburne University of Technology, and he brings quite a large and historical sort of personal experience to this conversation. Thank you for joining me, Hussein.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tell me, from your point of view, you look at this thing, the issue of surge capacity in our public transport system. What do you believe is our capacity, and particularly, I guess, when it comes to the regions, because we've had a lot of feedback so far from our listeners saying it's just not possible for them?
That's right. So people living in inner city areas, I think they would have, you know, good access. We have recently improved capacity through the metro, etc. People living in the outer suburbs, just because of the way our system is designed, it's not going to be as easy for them. So regional areas are also another issue. I think one lesson that we have learned over the years from these fuel shocks is that cities need to provide multiple alternatives and different alternatives for people to choose from.
We've got a text here that did come in saying, don't most buses require fuel? Because we heard from Infrastructure Victoria there that they believe that that's a good alternative in surge situations. But of course, things have changed recently with buses, haven't they?
That's right. I mean, the majority are still running on diesel, which is not good for the environment, etc. But increasingly, we are seeing trials of electric buses. When you think about it, electricity is produced locally. We don't need to rely on it being imported. So that is, for energy security, I think that is the way to go as well.
How much capacity do we need to factor in this situation? It's a situation which is, you know, we have the butterfly effect from a global crisis, and no one knows, literally no one knows when it's going to end. What's your estimation of what we should be looking at over what period of time?
So I think in the short term, the government should stabilize the supplies, and they have started to release some of the reserve. I know it's not enough, but that is, we need to stop the panic buying. We need to calm people. We've been through this before, several times, and I think again there are lessons to be learned. We need to adapt, and I think we have shown in the past as well that we can be resilient. But it is an issue, and I think the government is really trying to, not only in Australia, by the way, all over the world, governments are now struggling with this issue.
We'll get on to one of the many things that has been suggested, like fuel caps and so forth, and some of those creative solutions. But Hussein Dia, you had your own personal experience of living through one of the biggest oil crises in the world in the 80s in Jordan, which is totally reliant on imports. What do you remember of the time?
So living in Jordan during the Iraq war, I think it was late 80s or early 90s when things started to get complex, I saw firsthand the impact of shortages. So we saw demand management strategies used directly during the fuel stress. For example, cars with odd number plates could drive on odd days. So for example, today is the 16th. Mm-hmm. So only even number plates could drive.
Of course, we have letters at the end of our number plates now, so it'll have to be an alphabetical system.
That's right. So what happens is when there are these licenses, they just allocate them to a certain day. I mean, these are blunt instruments, but in cases of emergencies, they do reduce pressure quickly. And in many cases, we were encouraged to carpool.
Yeah. And what was it like to live through that as you're there?
Yeah, it was difficult because it also not only affected passenger cars, it affected road freight, it affected food supply. So it is quite distressing.
Yeah.
But again, I think we've learned a lot from these experiments.
It's 25 minutes past 11. We're talking about what we can do in terms of this fuel crisis that we are already in and how our public transport system might be able to live up to it. You're listening to Hussein Dia from the Swinburne University of Technology. Fred's called in from Central Victoria. We were talking about electric buses before then. Fred?
Yes, I'm here. Well, electric buses, no one's mentioned it. And I want to know where Victoria is because all around the world, you see, they've got electric buses, but where are we in infrastructure, Victoria, about future-proofing ourselves if this happens again? It will happen again.
Fred, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Hussein, but I believe that all new buses have to be electric. Is that right?
I think there is some mandatory requirement, if not all, probably the majority. And I think with electrification, we have started from behind in Australia, not only with the electric buses, but also in general. And I think these are very good, these are reminders that we should accelerate the shift.
Fred, thank you for your call. It's 27 past 11 and we're talking about fuel, how we cope with this. One of those ideas that have been bandied around over the past few days is a cap on how much a consumer can buy. So we have price freezes already that the state government has imposed from day to day. But a cap, for instance, I rock up, I can only spend $50. How would that work? Who would have the power to enforce that, Hussein?
So at the federal level, the government would enact the Liquid Fuel Emergency Act. So it would declare a fuel emergency. It would manage the national fuel supply, control fuel distribution, and it would give priority to essential users, for example, and also do, as you suggested, some rationing. It could be fuel coupons, it could be limits on liters per purchase, or priority allocations, and so forth. So the federal government would enact the legislation, and then I think state governments would start to look at implementation measures, such as car-free days or even driving rules, etc.
So the federal government would impose some of those caps, but the state government would effectively have to police it?
To police it, exactly. Because, the road rules and, anything related to the actual driving would need to be managed locally.
We've already had some texts about carpooling and some people are already doing that. Do you think that that's the sort of, where are we coming to education campaigns that might have to potentially be on the horizon?
That's right. And one interesting thing is that, for example, Uber, they do have an Uber pool service and it's quite successful. In the past, people used to be reluctant to carpool with neighbors, etc. But I think increasingly, it is quite an effective way. And we are doing it, through the digital platforms with Uber. Nothing stopping us from doing it with our neighbors.
And possibly some of those other companies that offer that same service. This on text, Hussein, e-bikes are a great way to commute, fun and zero fossil fuel use. Could we be seeing more of those hit the road? And I guess with all of the pros and cons that brings?
That's right. So, active travel, more, spaces for walking and bicycle lanes, e-scooters, e-bikes, because we need to provide variety. Not everyone can ride all of these tiny vehicles, so there needs to be priorities. And carpooling with digitalization, car sharing as well, all of these can help.
Hussein Dia, thank you so much for your insight this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hussein is a Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at the Swinburne University of Technology. I'm going to get back to your calls and texts, so many coming in about fuel. But just for the moment, let's change gears a little bit. Let's see what's happening in that glamorous world of the Oscars. You know you keep a half an eye on it, even though you say you're not interested. I'm joined again by Liam Burke, Associate Professor at Swinburne, who we talked to last week as a bit of a preview. Liam, you've been keeping your eyes on all of the prizes over there, and there's some history making, is that right? And a spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't want to know, maybe just switch off for about 30 seconds.
Yeah, some history making in that we had a tie in the best live action short category. And I can't remember a time when there was a tie. I mean, 50 years ago, there was one with Katharine Hepburn and Barbara Streisand, but there hasn't been one in kind of certainly my living memory. Now, not the kind of category everyone cares about, but it certainly brought some interest.
And there are hundreds of votes, aren't there, in the Academy? Yeah. So the odds of a tie would be minuscule.
There's a margin in which they're allowed to have a tie, but I think it's like about 5 votes. So this is, to your point, very rare, exceptionally rare.
Okay, so who were the ones who both won?
It was 2 short films, one called Singers, which if people like is on Netflix, so you can watch that, quite good. And another one made by The New Yorker called 2 People Exchanging Saliva. So, they're probably not the category everyone gets most excited about, but might get a bit of boost of interest due to this history-making moment.
I tell you the record that caught my eye just before we came on air, and it's something close to my own heart. It is a tie it's a record that is about a woman who has stuck around the industry and finally got her reward.
Absolutely. So Amy Madigan won for Best Supporting Actress. Her previous nomination came 40 years ago. So she won for Weapons, and she had this kind of star-making because she was already famous, but this sort of breakout role as Aunt Gladys, the very clown-like makeup for this antagonist, for this kind of very exciting kind of horror movie, and kind of came out of left field. So that's a great kind of late career Oscar for her.
Oh, fantastic. You were just saying last week that the Oscars are often about rewards for the veteran actors, let's put it that way, and it seems to be very much the case.
Absolutely. I think some of the other nominees were happy for her because they have many decades ahead, hopefully, to win an award themselves. The other major category that's been announced is Best Supporting Actor, and that went to Sean Penn, someone who has already won 2 Oscars, so probably didn't need another one. He was not there to accept his award, so probably somewhat disappointing for the likes of Jacob Elordi or Stan Skarsgård or Delroy Lindo, who were there, but he won for One Battle After Another. I mean, it's a standout role. Again, the villain, so they're both playing villains, so villains tend to win in supporting roles for that film.
Liam, thank you for your update. We will be crossing later to Hollywood itself to get all the razzle-dazzle from the red carpet, but thank you for joining from, I hope, your couch where you've got some popcorn and kicking back.
I'm at my office.
Oh, well, I hope you can kick back there. This is still work, right?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Liam, thank you. That's Associate Professor Liam Burke. He is Associate Professor of Cinema and Screen Studies Discipline Lead at Swinburne. We will, as I say, later this hour be crossing to Hollywood to get what it's like on the ground there. But coming up next, we'll continue our conversation about whether or not the public transport system where you are right now can cope with a surge that's driven by the oil crisis.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So many texts. I've just driven past Seaford Station, says Denise, and the parking is full. I've never seen it full on a Monday since COVID. So that could be eyes on the ground from Denise talking about this surge in public transport use already. Fiona's saying all places where buses pick up people should have seats. The elderly or disabled cannot access buses where there are no seats provided at the place people stop. Loads of texts coming in about people living with disabilities and how there is a lack of care there and a lack of capacity in planning. If there is a fuel cap, says Ruth, it should be litres, not dollars. My car can't take the cheap ULP, so unfair to be able to buy less because it's more expensive. And Andy from Wantirna South says, I think the federal government must make public transport free across the country for the duration of this oil supply shock. However, we do have a shortage of bus drivers in Victoria. I'd love to hear what you think. Keep those calls and texts coming. 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or 0437 774 774 to text. Daniel Bowen is spokesperson for the Public Transport Users Association, and his ears would have been burning hearing all of this discussion this morning. Hi, Daniel.
Morning, Mary.
What do you think of our capacity to handle a surge in this crisis?
Yeah, look, I guess I'd say public transport in Victoria and Melbourne, but, you know, the state more generally, is a real mixed bag. So you've got some, it really depends on where you are and where you need to travel to. You might find that you have a public transport option you can use and it's reasonably convenient. It may be at capacity or you know, increasing in crowdedness with this surge of patronage, or it may have space for you to get on board. So, you know, there could be differences there. In other areas of Melbourne and Victoria, though, you may not have a viable public transport option that can really get you to where you're going when you need to go. And that's obviously going to be an issue. And that's where we see people much more, I guess, stuck with driving and stuck with these high petrol prices.
So you're talking not just about regional areas, but also outer suburbs as well?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Look, there are parts of Melbourne where the only public transport within walking distance is a bus that might be once every 1 or 2 hours. So that's often not a great choice in terms of, you know, being able to get around. It may not fit with your timetable, when you need to be at work, when you need to be at, you know, uni, school, whatever it is, at an appointment. So I guess you would hope that governments are looking at this and seeing where they can boost public transport services to better meet people's needs so that more people have the option of leaving the car at home.
So many texts along this line. This from Mick from Gippsland. Hi, Mary. I assume you're only talking about public transport in Melbourne because out here in the sticks, it's ordinary at best, non-existent at worst. Hitchhiking might be more efficient. It's that bad.
Yeah, look, that's the reality in a lot of regional Victoria. Some of the town buses are not too bad. The V-line main train lines are not too bad, although often those are overcrowded as well, and it can be, you know, increasingly difficult to get a seat. But yeah, if you're making a trip where the trains don't run and the buses are very infrequent, then is that a great option for you? You know, it may not be.
Yeah. So in the short term, what do you think that the state government or the federal government indeed should do?
Well, the impact from petrol prices is real, and the public transport options are pretty sparse in some parts of Melbourne and Victoria and elsewhere around Australia, of course. So governments should be looking at what they can do to boost services. I think one of the, you know, texts you had talked about free public transport. Mm-hmm. I think it's more fundamental than that. It needs to be a service that people can actually use, that's viable for their trips, that can get them to where they're going when they need to be there. And that's just non-existent in a lot of areas at the moment.
Well, apropos, just as a last question while I've got you, there was the trial of the Mikey-less tap-on just for 4 train lines, not on others, this morning. So don't do that if you're changing to another line or you're getting onto a tram or a bus, because you'll have to be charged twice. It's not for concession holders either, but this trial is finally going ahead for a few weeks. Have you given it a go, Daniel, and what do you think?
Yeah, look, it's looking good so far. It is only on those 4 train lines, 2 in Melbourne, and which are Upfield and Craigieburn, and on the V-Line service out to Ballarat and Seymour. It's good to have this option. Again, it depends if you can actually use public transport for your trip, but if you can, this sort of technology will make it easier because you don't need to think about finding or buying a Mikey card. You don't need to think about what the fare is, loading that money onto your card. You just use your existing bank card, tap and go. So it's a lot easier. So it's great to have these options coming in.
Let's hope this trial works. Daniel Bowen, thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Daniel Bowen, spokesperson from the Public Transport Users Association. So many texts of yours coming in. I will want to get to those a little bit later. But coming up next, let's go to a quite different topic. I want to ask you, looking back on your birth experience, if you've been in that circumstance, what do you wish had been different? We're going to be talking about the importance of continuity of care.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 20 minutes to 12. Well, if you've had a baby, did you see the same midwife or doctor throughout your pregnancy? Or did you sometimes have to see different people each time? And did that affect how you experienced the birth? Because as we know, giving birth can be so joyous. But in fact, 28% or thereabouts of Australian women have described their most recent birth as traumatic. And that can involve physical injury, can involve fear for their life or the baby's life, or just feeling dismissed or unsupported during labour. So this research confirms what many of us have heard from friends, from family, as making a difference. Having the same midwife or doctor throughout pregnancy and during labour could be the key. Why does it matter so much? Why is it still not the norm for so many women? I'm joined now by Professor Hannah Darlin, midwifery researcher at Western Sydney University and one of the authors of the study. Thanks for joining us, Hannah.
Good morning.
When we talk about birth trauma, what are we actually talking about?
So you did a very nice summary, Mary. We're talking about either physical harm, which may impact on a woman's well-being afterwards, or psychological harm. And sometimes physical harm and psychological harm go together. But probably the majority of birth trauma is actually women feeling that they were not listened to, that they had things happen to them during the labour and birth they didn't consent to or wish they hadn't had later on if they'd been given more information. That's a very dominant feature in what we found.
So did I sum it up right? Around 28% of women describe their most recent birth as traumatic?
Yes, that's from our large national study with over 8,800 Australian women published a couple of years ago. We found 28% described their most recent birth as traumatic.
Is there any evidence, whether it be through this study or another, whether that is an increasing number or decreasing?
Look, there are all different studies around the world. Generally quoted around 30%. We know that in some countries it's higher. We know in some countries it's lower. And we are now repeating that study in 2026 to see if we see any changes that have happened between, you know, today and when we undertook the study back in 2021.
So according to your study, how much does continuity of care matter?
So continuity of care mattered hugely. We compared five models of care in Australian hospitals and systems. We compared all of those models to standard fragmented public hospital care. And we found that if you had a midwife in the public system who provided that care all the way through the pregnancy, the birth and the postnatal period, or privately, that you had significantly less intervention. You're more likely to go into labour on your own. You're more likely to have a vaginal birth. In fact, that was 11 times higher if you had a private midwife. You're more likely to not have a cesarean section. But interestingly, we also found really good outcomes for the baby, less likely to go to special or neonatal intensive care, but also less likely to have bottle top-ups when you wanted to breastfeed. And then really significantly, this half as likely to have a birth that was traumatic. And we found when you had an obstetrician, a private obstetrician, that halving of birth trauma was there, but under private obstetric care, you had much higher rates of intervention.
You're listening to Hannah Darlin, who is Professor of Midwifery at Western Sydney University, talking about a study that she co-authored that is about the importance of the continuity of care. Your study was done during the COVID period, I believe. Did the pressures on the health system at the time weigh into the results here?
Absolutely. And COVID was a time when increasingly things moved to telehealth, when people felt very nervous about coming into hospital. Often they didn't have their supportive people with them. So that continuity became this sort of very important link and advocate in the system that at that time was in crisis. But we're also re-looking at this in a population that wasn't during COVID, and we're finding similar patterns. So definitely during a time of incredible stress and fragmentation and depersonalization, continuity makes a difference. But we've also got randomized controlled trials now from around the world that show having this continuity of midwifery care reduces intervention, increases satisfaction, and there's also cost-effective.
Mm. If the evidence is so strong for continuity of care, and I guess it's not just through academic study, but certainly something that I've heard over and over again when comparing experiences between my friends, if it's so clear, why isn't it more widely available in Australia?
Very, very, very good question. So I think we know theoretically, and I think most people will accept it is, and it makes sense. You know, why would you want to go into this incredibly intense and personal experience without somebody who came on that journey with you that you trust and advocated for? But unfortunately, we've got a whole lot of things that are against us. We've got a workforce crisis, not enough midwives. We've often got midwives who aren't paid adequately for being on call for long periods of time over their life. The majority of midwives are female. They have young families and children. So the ability to drop everything at you know, a moment's notice and go in and catch a baby is complex. We often don't have hospitals that can manage this very organic way of working. So we've got a few factors that we really need to come to grips with to make sure this expands.
Yes, pointing to those sort of structural elements, Elsie has texted in saying, because midwives are humans with their own lives, surely it's often not possible for the timing to work for their presence at every client's birthing event. And Elsie's experience makes me think of my own, Hannah Darlin. I gave birth in the private system, but I gave birth on a Friday, and those first 4 days of my daughter's life, I saw very different nurses every single day with very different advice as well. There's something about, you know, weekends and holidays that doesn't allow this continuity of care.
Yes, I mean, in midwifery models, midwives are on call and they have all different arrangements. They also sometimes work as a couple of midwives together or the very small team where you get to know everyone in that journey. And we do know, actually, interestingly, postnatals where all models fall down. So exactly what you've just described, even though women are highly satisfied with continuity, and in our study, we showed they were much more likely to feel supported postnatally, it's still the area where we often find that if it's going to fall down, that's where it falls down, with conflicting information, different people giving different advice, which is why continuity is so important. The fewer people you engage with who give you the more consistent advice, the less confused you will be, especially as a new mother having your first baby.
I was confused. I can tell you that for sure. Caitlin Hawthorne has texted saying, women are sold a story that natural birth is beautiful. It's really not. All birth is traumatic. I guess, Professor Darlin, what would you say to someone who's pregnant now about questions they should be asking their maternity care to get the best experience possible? I understand what Kate's saying. There's a certain level of profound challenges that will come potentially even if you've got the best care. How can you optimise the chances of that happening?
Absolutely. So I find it quite fascinating that we do all of the research in our lives about, you know, buying a fridge and a microwave and what's going to be the best thing for us. And we do much less when it comes to childbirth. So I think what's really important is for women to think about what matters to them. What do they really want? What kind of birth do they want? What kind of family surroundings do they have? What kind of things have been important in their life? And then to do some research on the model of care that may fit you. So, for example, we found also low rates of birth trauma under private obstetric care, but much higher rates of intervention. However, some women want cesarean. Some women want higher rates of intervention. So what seems to be optimal is when the philosophical needs of a woman and their provider are in alignment and they go on that journey together with that aligned philosophy. So do the research, find out, interview people, find out what the intervention rates are in your provider or in your hospital, and make sure you're comfortable with the person who goes on that journey with you.
Yes, trying to do a little bit of research. Anyway, I wish it was as easy as just Googling the best care. But thank you very much for your guidance, Hannah Darlin.
My pleasure.
That's Professor Hannah Darlin, midwifery researcher at Western Sydney University, one of the authors of that study talking about the importance of continuity of care. And this from Jeff, yet another example of our two-tier health system. We should have a universal health scheme, just like the Nordic countries. But sadly, the profit-making health funds would squeal like stuck pigs at this suggestion. Keep all of your texts coming through on that. And we will also go back to some calls and texts about fuel situation, whether our public transport system can withstand any surge in demand going from this crisis. I also would like to say, if anyone who is feeling a little bit vulnerable after that last conversation, I thought it worth mentioning that there is the Australian Birth Trauma Association that can give you support as well. PANDA, the Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia, can also help you. And there's a national helpline, 1300 726 306. That's 1300 726 306. Stick around. The hour is not over. We will get back to fuel. But next, let's get a little bit of razzle-dazzle.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 9 minutes to 12. Joining us now is Reid Butler, US correspondent for Nine News, who is outside the Dolby Theatre as we speak. Of course, inside is where the Oscars all happen. He's been following all the red carpet developments in our morning. Reid, what's the vibe like there?
Oh, Mary, it is. I feel like it is definitely fair to say this is the biggest day on the LA, the Hollywood calendar. It is a really, really exciting vibe. You've got hundreds of people kind of gathered out the front of the theatre, hoping that they can catch a glimpse of one of the stars getting in, getting dropped off in their golf buggies or in their kind of limousines. And it is, it's really, really, really fun here. Perfect weather. So actually, pretty hot, but it's awesome. It really feels exciting.
In fact, I think I saw a picture of someone turning up in a cashmere cardigan. That must have been a stylist really, you know, imposing their will on them at that point, if you're doing it when it's hot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been on red carpets before when the stars are not in a good mood because it is so hot. You get absolutely nothing from them. So I'd be worried about interviewing whoever is in that cardigan, I think.
Oh, but there's nothing like a cranky
celebrity. Yeah, it's really,
really
cool here.
Yeah. Hey,
my gosh, I've dealt with quite a few.
I had some bets on whether Timmy Chalamet would turn up in a tutu singing opera, but he didn't.
What a disaster of a press tour for Chalamet. Seriously, he was the shoo-in for best actor in Marty Supreme, the movie about ping pong. He played a ping pong player, and then he starts throwing all this shade on ballet dancers and opera singers. But his category hasn't come up yet, but I don't think it's looking too good for him. I think it's probably going to be Michael B. Jordan, who was played twin brothers in the movie Sinners, which was just incredible. I think it's going to be Michael B. Jordan that takes out that Oscar, and that would be really cool. I think he was phenomenal in that movie, and he's a great bloke by all accounts. But I think Timmy's blown it.
Timmy's blown it. Oh, I wonder if all the you know, hidden opera singers and ballet dancers in the room will boo him when he comes up on screen.
Hey, yeah,
Reid, you've been watching over the past few days how all this gala gets together. What's it like behind the scenes?
It's the definition of a show. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, potentially working behind the scenes to get this together. Right now, I'm looking at the security presence here. 1,000 security personnel are here. There are snipers on the roof and the hotels around me right now outside the theatre. You've got choppers, blimps, skywriting, everything over above. It is a huge production. Now, interestingly, the red carpet is kind of a little bit dialed back this year. It certainly hasn't got all the big sort of gold chains and things like that we've seen in the past. It's kind of got an autumnal vibe, garden kind of feel. It's a little bit dialed back, but yeah, a huge production. I was on the red carpet yesterday as I was setting up, and it was just so fascinating to see people. There are people, stand-ins, who have a placard around their necks with the name of the actors, and they're kind of walking, testing the lights so they can make sure the lights are all good. These volunteers who pretend to be Emma Stone for the day.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's all of those kind of little things. It's really cool.
Do they get sort of body lookalikes and so forth to walk in?
No. Absolutely not. They didn't look anything like the celebrities, but I think they were having a great time. It was really fun.
Reid, do you even get to go inside and watch and have some champers, or are you herded out there with plebs of the press in some sort of pen?
I cannot tell you how good a glass of champagne would be right now, Mary. But no, we're sort of in the press area. I'm in the interview room where the winners come to do a little spiel to the press afterwards, which is really cool. But we actually organised through Visit California a helicopter to arrive at the Oscars today for our Crosses on the Today Show this morning. So, yes, I arrived in style, but when I got here, it kind of reached a screeching halt, and I'm just with it.
Hope you enjoyed it while you could. Reid Butler, thank you for giving us an insight. Reid Butler, US correspondent for Nine News. Getting a little bit of glamour there, but just not much. We have been talking about the fuel prices and whether our public transport system can actually step up. Maggie has called from Veronia. What do you think? Hi, Maggie. What do you think? Do you think that we're prepared with our public transport?
Well, I have recently started using the bus area, and it really amazes me, no matter how many people get on the bus, no one but me clicks on.
Oh.
If the owners of these great big buses and have to pay the drivers ever looked at the records of how many people use the bus, I don't think they keep running them, which would be awful.
Yeah, Maggie, if it gets to fare evasion, taking buses off the road, that's the last thing we need. Thank you so much for calling, and thank you to everyone who has called and texted over the past hour about the public transport situation. The Allen government says, one texter says, should make public transport free for school kids and help get mums' SUVs off the road. Earl, who's saying, forget cars, get e-bikes, less cars, less fuel, less, more exercise, less emission. What's the downside? Thank you so much for joining me today in the Conversation Hour. It's been really fascinating. You can catch it again if you look for the Conversation Hour podcast on the ABC Listen app, or you can email me, conversationhour@abc.net.au. Join me again tomorrow.